So I appreciate Simple Action Scrambling coming up with this format. Regardless of what's going on outside of the walls of our house, we need each other. I need you guys, and we'll figure this out together. And this is the first step. If it's clumsy and not practiced, that's me, so it'll be perfect. So my story starts, I'm the youngest child, three kids, two parents. My parents were married until the end of my dad's life, no divorce. The household growing up was centered around alcohol. I was introduced to alcohol, I'm sure, on the day I was born. And my parents were both heavy hitters, and they both suffered long for it. They took my dad's life. My mother is currently still alive in Arizona. She has been diagnosed and is currently a wet brain alcoholic. She requires full-time care. She is still at home. And my brother and sister, both of whom are older than me, have had their problems with alcohol. They both quit. They've used different methods in Alcoholics Anonymous. I support them both in that. Me. And I found my way to Alcoholics Anonymous after the brief drunk log I'm going to share. I don't want to share too many of the harrowing details that David talked about, but a few of them just so that I can qualify. I was born in the Midwest. I was born in a little river town in Illinois, Moline, Illinois. And we moved quite a bit when I was a kid. Just my dad, by the nature of his job, we moved a lot. And I know people in the program that are friends of mine that have had problems with jumping around place to place, either being military brats or their parents just moved around a lot. We did, and it didn't bother me. I was always pretty adaptable. And I learned very early on that alcohol, and in my case, drugs, helped with that adaptability. I was very uncomfortable being around people by myself. I had this deep-seated fear, which I identified after I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, that if you got to know the real me, you'd run. And so I won't show you that guy, but there is a guy I'll show you, and you'll like that guy because he'll be the life of the party guy, and he'll be the loudest guy, and he'll be the guy with the drugs, and he'll be the guy getting into trouble, and he'll be the guy cracking jokes. My dad, one of the funniest, loudest people I've ever been around. And when he got 20 or 30 beers in him, he was funnier and louder. He never really got to that point where he would be the slurring. My dad was 6 foot, 4 inches tall, 275, 280 pounds in his prime. And he could drink 30 beers and do anything. He could drink 30 beers and go to church. He could drink 30 beers and mow the lawn. I mean, he had an amazing capacity for liquor, which he paid for. And I wanted to be like that. People laughed around my dad. And I noticed that right off, and I liked it. And so the first time I ever was around alcohol was at a function that my whole family was at, extended family, cousins, aunts, uncles, had a cousin that got married. And the people that I liked the most out of those 200 or 300 people that were at that wedding all stayed, you know, this far away from the keg all night. They got in a circle around the keg. They stayed around that keg until it ran out, and they moved over to another keg, and they just moved from keg to keg all night. And they, as the night wore on, they got funnier, the music got louder. And I was a little kid, 5 or 6 years old, and they would just let me drink with them. Just, here's a beer. You're standing here. You're a man, 5, 6 years old. Be a man. Drink this beer. And I loved it. The first time I could clearly ever remember alcohol touching the back of my throat, I've heard people in AA describe it differently. I appreciate everybody's perspective on that particular event. For me, when alcohol hit the back of my head, it was like an explosion went off. It's the best way I can describe it. It's the best I'd ever felt. I felt instantly like I went from being over here, a little kid, to I was standing with the men, and I was cracking jokes with the men, and the men who everybody was paying attention to. And I'll never forget it. And from that second, and again, people have different experiences in AA, but for me, from that second, I was hooked on alcohol. I could never get enough of it. Unlike a lot of my friends in AA, I never tried to control it. I didn't even know that was a possibility. Like that was something you should shoot for or whatever. Like, hey, I'm going to control alcohol. That was never my story. I never even thought about doing that. I would have considered it a flight to alcohol, I guess. I would have considered it a, like I was somehow letting it down, or it was my best friend. It was the thing that was always with me. It was the one stabilizing effect in my life, and never felt lonely. I always felt like I had a go-to, and I just was very loyal to alcohol. And I was pretty sure, well, right up until the day that I slammed into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was pretty sure it worked. I know that sounds crazy for people like us who it doesn't really work that well for, but up until the point I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, I was pretty sure alcohol worked. And I wish people would have pointed, I think people did point out to me that it wasn't working. So I won't say I wish that I had, I think people were pointing that out to me along the way. After my brother and sister went off to college is when I started to get in trouble. They are much older than me. And 13, I got a joyriding in my mom's car, and I was drunk, so I got a DUI. And they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. So first AA meeting was when I was 13 years old, at a time when there were not a lot of 13-year-olds in AA. And that meeting was one guy. He was very unwelcoming. He asked me what I was there for. I told him, showed him my sheet, which had five spots on it for him to sign. And he snatched that sheet out of my hand, signed all five, and said, there's a door. So thank you, AA. Appreciate you welcoming me home. The times after that that I got into trouble, just like the old AA adage, I didn't get into trouble every time I drank, but every time I got into trouble, I had been drinking. And I got into some weird troubles. A lot of my friends in AA know the story about the school. I'll tell that because I don't recognize a lot of names online. The reason why it's poignant to me this week, it happened right around the time that I got that DUI. A friend of mine's older brother, who was clearly an alcoholic by the time he was 17 or 18 years old, he was the one that I went to buy beer when I was 12, 13, 14. He bought us beer. He bought us beer that night. He died this week. He passed away earlier this week from lung cancer. And a man in his late 50s dying of lung cancer, not that abnormal, but Mark was a person who would smoke five packs of cigarettes a day. He would drink 24 beers a day. He would do all the drugs he could get his hands on, and he paid a heavy price for that and died just this week. So anyway, it was personally impactful for me. He bought us beer one night, not that unusual. We went out to a new school that had been built, not that unusual. We launched a bunch of fireworks into a dumpster. Again, not that unusual. That dumpster happened to be filled with almost 400 gallons of petroleum-based vinyl finisher that the shop teacher had tried to surreptitiously throw out without disposing of it properly. And then it covered with a bunch of paper, wood, which acted like a wick. And so once that paper and that wood got hot enough, it started to burn much hotter than I thought it should. And so we jumped on our mopeds drunk and rode around the side of the building just in time for it to explode. This giant, you know, 20 cubic yard dumpster full of very flammable liquids exploded behind us. And that school had cost in the $2 to $3 million range to build. It was brand new and it was on fire, thanks to my friend and I. That's the kind of stuff that happened to me when I was drinking. I could never really predict what was happening. I always felt like I got a bad deal. But once I got into AA, I realized that I had put myself in all those positions. And a lot of times bad stuff didn't happen. I used to be the person in AA that when somebody would share, well, I never got any DUIs. I didn't come here because of drinking and driving. I'd always think, well, I got three of them. And then after I'd been in AA a while, I started thinking, I only got three of them. I mean, as much as I drink and drove, I could have gotten three every week or every couple of weeks, I could have gotten three DUIs. At the end, I could have got a DUI twice a day. And, you know, I have a weird history with DUIs and getting into trouble. My second DUI, I don't recommend this, but because of my nerves, I thought I would smoke some pot before I went into court. Smoking some pot would have been okay, but I smoked pot for a couple hours. So when I went to court, it was pretty recognizable how stoned I was. And the judge said, first thing, young man, have you been smoking pot this morning? And because I was so stoned, I thought I'd be honest. And I said, yes, Your Honor, I have. And he immediately pointed over there and put me right in jail overnight. Though I wasn't stoned, and I stayed in front of him. That kind of stuff just followed me because of my drinking. And not only legal stuff, but the relationships that were lost, the events that all ended up on my amends list. When I took my inventory for my fourth step and did my first eight step list, I was surprised by the number of people on it. And by the time I got in front of them, I was surprised at how upset they all were. Because I was like the guy in the big book who just roared through the lies of others. I got mad when you got mad at me. I couldn't believe that you were mad at me. I mean, I'm just doing my thing. What are you upset about? And that kind of attitude did not serve me well. I've met a lot of men in Alcoholics Anonymous that have had very similar experiences. That happens to be mine. Alcohol never did me the favors that I thought it was doing me. And instead, what it was doing, and I didn't notice this because I was drunk and I was scared most of the time, and I was living full of fear, and I was trying to tamp that down with alcohol. What I did notice is how fast it was taking things away from me. I didn't realize the parts of my soul that alcohol and drugs were stripping away. And in my case, thankfully, it did it fast. I'm glad that, unlike my parents who had this kind of alcohol sucks and they just slid for just decades on it just being terrible, and they never had the kind of social ills or work-related or legal troubles or anything that would make them wake up and say, hey, maybe I should do something different. For them, it was just like letting the air out of the alcoholic balloon over a long period of time. And that didn't happen for me. Like I said, when that explosion happened to me after my first drink, it just kept exploding. And I kind of knew in the back of my head, because I was sometimes in the front of my head, because I was around people who did drink normally. There are lots of those people. Almost everybody, I think, can drink relatively normally, certainly compared to the way that I drank and a lot of my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous drank. Most people weren't doing that. And I noticed that most people were not drinking the way I was drinking. I knew that. And it made me very uncomfortable. I didn't really understand it. I knew I was the topic of conversation a lot. I'll give you a good example. I liked the attention, by the way. But at a party a year or so before I got sober, I was running short on rent. There were a couple hundred people at this party, and it was a fun party. It was like you would expect of a bunch of teen, early 20s people just thrown down and partying. And I was short on my rent, and everybody knew it. And so as the night got later, they got together a collection of money and bet me $200, which was probably all the money I had in the world and not enough to pay my rent. I think my rent was probably in the $350 range at that time. They bet me $200 that I would not drink a shot of bleach, like Clorox, like putting your clothes bleach. And they poured it out and put it on a table. And they bet me $200 I wouldn't drink it. And I'm not sure if it would have mattered if I was drunk or not, but I was drunk. Not only was I drunk, I needed money for rent. And there was $200 sitting next to that shot of bleach. I grabbed it and put it right down. Didn't even think about it. Nobody at that party thought, except maybe the guy that bet me, who knew me better than anybody else there. He knew I would do it. And he wanted to see the reaction. And I knew I would do it because I was drinking stuff that was killing me anyway. I knew that. The bleach might have been a different kind of killing, but everything I was drinking at that point was killing me, and I knew it. And I really didn't care. That was the year that the movie Less Than Zero came out, Robert Downey Jr., 1987. And I went to that movie with a bunch of friends of mine, and they all thought my life, without the money, mirrored Robert Downey Jr.'s character. And they used to always say the only difference between me and him is that I hadn't died yet. And so against that backdrop, as I started to have more and more problems with alcohol, I started to get more and more isolated from people that were afraid to be around me. They didn't want to be there at the end when I dropped and couldn't get back up. So freshman year in college, I had an overdose. I didn't mean to. I just did. Just worked out that way. I lost track, as I often did. And that night, I lost track too far. And it nearly took my life. And at that hospital, my parents came down and they said for me to tell my brother and sister that I'd fallen out of bed. I was on the second, the top of a bunk bed with my roommate freshman year in college. And they wanted me to tell my brother and sister a lie because they didn't like the truth. They wanted me to tell them that I'd fallen out of the bed and hit my head on the floor, and that's why I was in the hospital. Meanwhile, I was on the ward where they put crazy folks. And at noon that day, they asked me to go to a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, which met in that hospital at 12 every day. And I went. And I went and just stuck my head in that meeting. And I know everybody in there saw me because I was in the, you know, you could see my, I was in one of those robes that showed my whole backside. And I just kind of peered my head in, and I was like, I am not going in that room. That was a scary looking bunch of people. and so I couldn't go in. I thought there was an amazing amount of happiness in that room. And they had probably seen a lot of people like me peer their head around the corner and then leave. Because as I was leaving, I thought they were laughing. And I thought they were laughing at me. And now I know that they were laughing because they had been peering around the corner and they weren't anymore. And I knew that. I knew that I was very much on the outside. The only way I would have felt inside is if I had been drunk or high. And even that wasn't working anymore. So what I did after I got kicked out of college directly for my drug use is I joined the service. And I've told that story a few times. I thought about joining the Army, but I didn't like that guy. I was really, really stoned. And about the fourth hour on a couple of tabs of acid when I went in and talked to the Marine Corps guy. And he just scared me. He immediately started talking about killing people, which when you're tripping, you don't want to talk to people about killing others or any other time really, but especially when you're on LSD. So I didn't like that guy, but I went over to the Navy recruiter who was just leaving his office 5 minutes till five in the afternoon. Is a man named Jack Hansen. He's a Navy recruiter in Liberty, Missouri, where I was crashing with my parents for the summer after I got kicked out of college. And I said, can I talk to you about joining the Navy? And he said, nope, I'm off work. You have to come back in the morning. And he's locked up and he turned around and then he goes, but I'm going over to the bar. You want to grab a beer? And I was like, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, I do want to grab a beer. And so he and I closed the place. 2 o'clock in the morning, we're arms around each other, best friend. Next day, I was in the Navy. I'm not even sure I remember when that happened. And but he was happy to recruit me. And Holocaust him was a hefty bar tab. And so I was off to the service, and I went to a school down in Orlando, Florida, and it was a decently tough school. I'd always been good at academics, as are my brother and sister, and I went to a school down in Orlando, Florida to study naval nuclear power, and I went through the A school. All that was going okay. I had reduced my drug use to just LSD because everything else would show up on ear analysis. So I was dropping acid a couple times a week and drinking every night. 21 years old by that time, and just living in Florida and going to school and just trying to hide from everybody that I had this problem that they didn't have, and really sneaking drinking a lot to calm my nerves, the stressful school that took up, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week with classroom and study outside of classroom. I was in the meat of the last portion of Naval Nuclear Power School, which at that time, my school was 26 weeks long. 24th week, I couldn't take the pressure anymore. And I felt real bad. It was the first time that drinking had ever got to me like that, where I just could not go more than a couple hours without drinking a bit. And I thought I'd blow it out this week, this last weekend. And on July 4th of 1990, I dropped a bunch of acid. I had a bunch of acid with me. I drank all day. Went to the fireworks, just drank and drank and drank. And I could not drink fast enough or enough. And I drank until the people who were with me were all the way passed out. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning on the July 5th. And I thought, I'm driving. Yeah, let's drive. We got somewhere to go and we're not going to get there by walking. It's too far. I knew distance and 10 miles seemed like a long ways to walk at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I jumped behind the wheel of the car and started driving. And I don't really remember that, but I do remember vaguely understanding that I was on the wrong side of the divided highway. I was driving the wrong way because there were cars just zinging past me on all sides. And when I looked up into the rearview mirror of my friend's car, which was a late 80s model Isuzu Impulse, little tiny chunky car, two doors, sunroof open, 4 o'clock in the morning, When I looked behind me, there were an amazing number of police officers behind me, like more police than I thought there even were police. I saw so many lights behind me that I thought, man, they're all after me, everybody. And I looked down at the speedometer, and I thought I was going about 80 or 90 miles an hour, and I looked down at the speedometer under the influence of LSD and realized I was going like 15. And so slow speed chase down the wrong way of a divided highway, and I thought, I'm going to run. Time to run. Got plenty of speed left in here. And so I started to pick up speed just about the time that this incredibly bright light just burst through the sunroof right into the gear shift area. Just a blinding light. And so here's my public safety announcement that I always give during my sharing my experience, Strength and Hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. When the sheriff's helicopter joins the police chase, that police chase is over. So as soon as you see the sheriff's helicopter, stop. I did not heed that advice that evening. And as soon as the helicopter light all came on, I was like, I can outrun them. They don't have radios or faster cars or helicopters or all that stuff. I'll get away. I'm sure I can. And so I took off. I just, as fast as I could, with all the functions I had at the time, the faculties I had at the time, I tried to run, and I was not successful. When they finally caught me, they were very upset. And surprise, surprise, when the police turn all those lights on, they want you to pull over and comply. And I didn't do that. And so they were rough on me when they arrested me. And justifiably so. I don't look back at that with any animosity. I was a young look. I looked like I was in shape, and I was a kind of a violently struggling, non-compliant, clearly out of my mind. And so they arrested me, DUI and reckless driving, and I was on the wrong side of the highway, and I fled, and I resisted arrest. Not sure about that part, but that's what they said. And I had 50th LSD with me, and I was in the service. And so they put me in jail, and they did not give me a bond. And I stayed in there 5 days. And during that 5 days, I got more sick than I'd ever been in my life. I threw up all the time, and I couldn't stop, and I could not eat food. The food would get underneath me, and the smell would just be, ugh. And I know those kinds of withdrawals now are pretty common, but I didn't know what they were at the time. And so by about the fourth day, I'm still in a drunk tank. I'm still cold all day. I'm on the stainless steel stuff because I'm throwing up all the time. And I started using the real thick, viscous blue toilet water to clean my face off with. And that blue toilet water is because they put so many chemicals in it because it smells so terrible in the room. And the effect that has is it stains everything that gets on bright blue, like my cheeks, all down here, my shirt, everything was covered in my own vomit and stained bright blue. And so that's how I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I willingly went to, having not showered for days on end, sicker than I'd ever been in my life, covered in my own vomit. And a man from Alcoholics Anonymous, Jim S., who I'll never forget as long as I live, who was a AA old timer in the truest sense, and in a couple of months I'll be sober as long as he was then, which is hard to believe. He had a ongoing relationship with the Orange County Jail, and he walked in and he said, "You want to come with me to a meeting?" And I was like, "Can I get out of here any other way?" And the answer to that was no, and they released me to Jim's recognizance. And he took me to the Rebus Club in Castleberry, Florida, which is kind of up on the northeast side. If you've ever flown into Orlando, the airport's kind of down on the southeast side. Castleberry's up on the northeast side. And he took me to the Rebus Club. And I walked in there. My recollection is every AA meeting at that time was smoking. I certainly smoked myself. And I walked into that meeting, and it was filled with smoke and laughter and the smell of coffee and people who were friendly. And they all seemed real glad to see me. Like, look at that fellow right there. He is not doing well. And people very welcoming, and people, so we hug each other. We're not doing it right now because of this thing going on nationally. And that'll pass. We'll be hugging each other again soon. No doubt about that. Back then, the hugs are probably similar to what they'd be right now, maybe even less. They were kind of hugging out like this, kind of avoiding my pukey area. I didn't smell very good, but they were at least glad to see me, and I knew that. And they were getting me coffee, and they were grabbing me donuts. And the donuts, I said the thing about food in jail, but I must have hit that meeting at the perfect time because I was like, oh, sugar and coffee. And people just handed me lit cigarettes. I was like, man, this place is awesome. I'm all jacked up on sugar and caffeine and I'm smoking. And the meeting's an hour and a half long. And they asked anybody if there was a newcomer. And I didn't have to raise my hand. I think people knew, but I raised my hand, said, my name is Trent. I'm an alcoholic. And all I remember about that meeting is that feeling like, okay, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to try this. And the only reason I did is because, well, a couple of reasons. I won't say the only reason, but the number one reason is alcohol and drugs had made my social calendar impressively light. Like, I didn't have anywhere to be just then. Nobody had missed me when I was in jail. I would say if I had died the first 90 days I was in sobriety, I'm not sure anybody would have noticed outside of a few AA people. I'd alienated my whole family, any friend I'd ever had. They were all gone anyway. And so what I liked about Alcoholics Anonymous is just people just kind of absorbed me into what they were doing. They're like, this is, we're doing this. And if you want what we have and you're willing to do these things, then come in with us. But they weren't trying to convince me. My first kind of core group of people, they were the type of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that would say, so you didn't like the meeting tonight, Trent. What didn't you like about it? And I would just, whoa, you know, I had my critiques of what Alcoholics Anonymous needed to do and how it needed to change and how it needed to be run. And I figure 70, 80 days, they ought to start listening up to what I got cooking. And they would say stuff like, all right, Trent, well, once you come up with a worldwide program that has millions of people and literature, proven format for recovery, then you come back to us. But until then, we're just going to go ahead and do AA. All right, we're not doing what you're doing. We already did what you're doing. We're doing something different. You can be a part of that. But they were very pointed, and I make this point sometimes when I think it's salient. If I didn't like what they were doing, they would point and say, there's the door. That same door that brought you in here, it'll take you right back out. Good luck. We'll be here when you come back. And they were so sure that I would come back if I survived. I just thought, maybe I can do what they say and just take the cotton out of my ears, put it in my mouth, which was constantly running, and just listen and just see. And they said, if you don't like AA after a year or so, I mean, what, you can go do what you were doing before. We'll refund you your misery. You don't have to stay here. Nobody's trying to make you do anything. And they made it very clear that Alcoholics Anonymous is all volunteer, that they were not going to convince me of anything. I asked David before the meeting whether or not we were going to do any readings. And so I clearly love and I'm a fan of the Big Book. In case you haven't seen it, there's one right there. In that book, after the discussion about step three, and it's just getting ready to start step four, the sentence is, being convinced we are at step three, which is that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood him. The wording of that sentence, the first time I ever heard it, I was like, being convinced. So it's my responsibility. It doesn't say, now that we've convinced you. It says, being convinced. And although it's a subtle distinction, for the people in here that are newer, say in your first couple of years, it's incredibly important for at least me to note that Alcoholics Anonymous was there for me. It was up to me to step into AA. AA would meet me halfway. You know, I've always gotten all the help that I've needed. But I had to make the choice. And so when people are struggling in sobriety, my thought is always that they haven't made that choice. How it works starts out with, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And what that sentence says to me is that if I do it, that certain things are going to happen. And that those certain things seem to be consistent throughout the AA fellowship. And so I did what people said when I got there. The guy that picked me up out of jail became my sponsor. The Rebus Club in Castleberry, Florida became my home group. I had a commitment when I was sober, less than 3 weeks, And a lot of people wouldn't understand this commitment now, but my first commitment in AA was to clean out ashtrays. And at that time, the group that I belonged to had a rash of people that were stealing ashtrays. I mean, you cannot trust alcoholics. They needed ashtrays. There were ashtrays at the meeting. They were like, well, they won't mind if we bother these, you know, borrow these permanently. And so then my home group established a protocol for checking out ashtrays. I know it sounds odd, but we actually had a ledger with all the ashtrays listed. We put little numbers on the ashtrays, and I checked them out at the beginning of every meeting, and then they had to check them in at the end. It was not popular, but that was my first job. And I learned very early on that people in AA that are sober a while get territorial, and that they like things a certain way, and they resented me checking out ashtrays. But what my first sponsor did is he got me to meet everybody in the group, and he got about a third of them mad at me. And he taught me the value of the first tradition. And so the first tradition was on my mind when David told me last Friday that we were going to attempt this. And like I said at the beginning, I've never done this. It made me nervous. And speaking in AA doesn't ever make me nervous anymore. This did, because I've never done it. And I'm so thankful to my higher power that he pushed me outside of myself to make me do something new. I want to keep doing new things, and this is new. When David talked about doing this online, I immediately thought about the first tradition. And the first tradition is that our common welfare should come first. And my personal recovery depends on AA unity. So what's AA unity? And at that time, I was very filled with fear when David, who's been a friend of mine a long time, who I love dearly, said that the meeting that I was going to be a part of and the meal that I was going to partake with a lot of my friends was not going to happen. And that filled me with fear. And filled me with fear because AA is important to me. It's a cornerstone of my life. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I thought, well, what are we going to do? It's not going to work out. That's always my default position. Whatever's going to happen, it's not going to work out. And I still do that. It doesn't matter how long I'm sober, it's not going to work out. And I don't care what you say, it's not going to work out. What I learned in AA, what AA taught me, is that say everything that I ever thought wasn't going to work out actually didn't work out. So throughout my sobriety, I've had all these periods of, well, it's coming up in 2 weeks or it's coming up in 5 weeks. And whatever that event is, it's just not going to work out. It's not only not going to work out, it's going to be terrible. And then I get 2 weeks out or I get 5 weeks out and the event passes. Generally speaking, it's usually fine. And I've realized in my sobriety that if it was like I projected it to be, I would have the worst life of anybody that's ever lived in the history of mankind. And that hasn't happened. I have a good life. And so that thought that it's not going to work out, it is going to work out. And one of the ways it's going to work out is for people who love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think everybody in here tonight probably does. Or else you wouldn't be willing to go to these lengths, which are pretty weird. It's going to work out because people like us show up and because we want to figure it out. And if we get together, like David asks a bunch of us to get together on Saturday, and there are a bunch of us logged in, and a couple of the home group members who I don't know personally well had some of the great salient points about anonymity that really made me dig this weekend and realize how much that I not only love Alcoholics Anonymous, I can still learn stuff all the time. And they pushed me to do that. And so if I just shown up like the incredible expert that I am in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight in front of all you people and dazzled you with my speaking brilliance, I wouldn't have learned the lesson that I learned by having to do it this way. By standing in my office, in my house, I'm down in Southern Shores, North Carolina with my wife, Cecilia. We live in this beautiful place. And I'm standing right here talking to people all over. A friend of mine in Colorado, a couple who's very important to me, who's driving through North Carolina right now, just having barely scraped home from Las Vegas today as it shut down behind them. A friend of mine in Las Vegas that talked about logging on. We are spread out. And that's not the way that, at least in my mind, I would have it. I'd rather be up there tonight. And my friend Iran was logged on earlier. I hope he's still here. I probably lost him. He's got a short attention span. Love you, Iran. But if I'd have seen him tonight, he would have picked me up off the ground and hooked me. No doubt about it. And that kind of hug, I will miss the next couple of weeks. No doubt about it. I'm going to miss that. But what we'll do is we will do what we're doing right now, and we will learn how to do it together. And the funny thing about the spirit of community is so I've shared this. I got sober July 5th, 1990, and a lot of people listening that I might not have been sober then. I'm sure that that's true. The first thing I got in AA, along with my white chip, was I got a quarter. And the quarter was taped to my white chip. And the reason they gave me a quarter is because if you had to call somebody in AA back then, you had to use a payphone. I didn't have a phone that I was carrying around in my pocket. I didn't have this fancy little robot that I carry with me everywhere. I didn't have that. I had to walk somewhere and go to this thing that used to be attached to the outside of a building. I'm leading you people through that don't know. We actually had phones outside. They could stand the weather. They had coins on the front. You put it in, you call somebody. And that's how I called people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how I connected to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, was on the phone. I also connected to them in person. I also went out to dinner with them. Some of that stuff we're probably not going to be able to do the next couple of weeks. But I did talk to them on the phone. And some of my best times in AA have been talking to people on the phone. What happened was, for the people that don't know, July 5th, 1990 was 27 days before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Had that not happened, I would have been drummed out of the military, I'm sure, on another denial or a bad conduct discharge. But I fell through the cracks. Because we were all of a sudden in a state of war, which we had not been in for 15 years, the higher-ups otherwise would have landed on me like a ton of bricks for getting busted with drugs, popping a piss test, getting a DUI, all the trouble I was in with the police. All of a sudden, I'm like, yeah, you're going to war. You're in the Navy. We're going to stick you on a ship, and you're going to the Persian Gulf, which happened to me. And during that time, what I did was I called the woman in the room behind me, who I had just married. I had met her in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were both in our first year, and so everybody was pretty much against that. I had a good friend at the time who I asked, like, do you think it's a good idea if I get married to her? And he's like, can you pick her out of a crowd of people? I was like, yeah, I can. He goes, well, you've crossed the AA threshold. Marry away. And so we got married, and that's been 29 years ago this summer, and here we are. When I was overseas, I would call her on the phone, and I barely knew her. And we would get these phone cards, and when we were in Bahrain, or when we were in Kuwait, or when we were in the United Arab Emirates, all places I went to AA meetings, by the way. AA at that time had an international directory, and I looked up the meeting in the directory and walked right through various Islamic neighborhoods to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Probably not smart, but I'm grateful that I did it now. I would call her on the phone, and I got to know her by doing a much lesser version of what we're doing right now. At least I can see a few people here, and I can see friends of mine's faces. I couldn't even do that when I started. And so I share all that to say that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous clearly has always worked for me and for millions of others. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when people are like, well, do we have a program? Do we have a fellowship? Bill Wilson was very specific when he wrote the preamble, the only thing that David read tonight, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship. He could have said anything, but he said Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. And that's because that's what he was doing at the time. He was talking to people. He was trying to help drunks. And so we are clearly a fellowship. The fellowship has always been an integral part of my life. And so back in the days when I talked about when you had to call people on payphones, I was traveling. I got out of the service. I started my own company, and I was traveling for business. And at that time, no robot. I couldn't pick up this thing and go take me to the nearest meeting, and then 5 minutes away, I was whisking away with an integrated map program and all that, giving me point by point. That didn't happen back then. I had to call somebody on the phone. I had to say, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here in Sumter, South Carolina, and I need a meeting tonight. And I had to ask for help to somebody I was talking to on the phone, and they had to come get me. And that kept me sober. And so, you know, I want to encourage people that have been very worried about all this, and I get the worry. I don't think anybody can stay sober long enough to escape worry, and I certainly haven't. But my phone works, and I will pick it up as much as I'm able to. Luckily for me, it's been ringing a lot the last couple of days. And, you know, when new guys, and I was one of those ones, say, well, I don't want to bother you. It's no bother. just keep doing it until I tell you it's a bother. Keep calling the people in your home groups that are sober a long time until they say, don't call me anymore, which will never happen. Just keep calling. And, you know, for me, the whole point of specifically steps 10, 11, and 12 is I'm trying to keep my side of the street as swept as I possibly can, for sure. I'm trying to improve through prayer and meditation my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, for sure. I'm trying to do that. But mostly I'm trying to stay tied in with you people so that if you guys need help, like I needed help, that somebody like me is standing there and saying, I'll help. We'll get through this. There are people that I know in the last, you know, 5 or 10 days that have, for the first time in a long time, have talked to me about, I mean, I've had dreams about drinking. I'm thinking about drinking, or I just don't feel right, or a lot of those kinds of feelings. And the nice thing, and I've got friends on here who have been sober a long time. I saw Margaret and Mike earlier, and some other people are logged on. My friend Jacob logged on. My friend Derek logged on. People who've been sober a long time, I don't feel like drinking right now. And I'm totally jazzed about that. That feeling has never gone away. And I also feel pretty okay, because I have faith developed by time in Alcoholics Anonymous and practicing the principles that's contained in that big book that I held up, really big book in my case. The principles in that really big book work today. It's a design for living that works in rough going. It's a word for word quote out of the book. And so this might be what I would qualify after just short of 30 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll go ahead and say this is rough going, and go ahead and give people permission to use that phrase liberally, because I've been sober 30 years just short of, and I've never seen anything like this. And I've never had friends call me up and say, hey, I want to put you on the magic box and project it out that I was like, what? I like on the line, but I'd rather be in person. I would. But I want people to get help and receive help. And I know that we're going to be able to do this. I just know it. But we're going to have to do things that make us uncomfortable. I know for me, the best times in Alcoholics Anonymous have been when I've been forced to do things that have made me uncomfortable. And then I come out the other side and I think, number one, that wasn't that uncomfortable. Number two, man, did I really learn a lesson from that. And so we have an opportunity now. You know, the guys that are sober a couple of years that are like, is this the way it always is? No, it's not always this way. But the program that's kept you sober the last couple of years, or the last 10 years, or the last 20 or 30 or 40 or whatever time frame you're in, that same program will see us through this. And the first tradition all but guarantees it. But the first tradition, more than anything else, points out to me that A is a participation sport. You don't participate, you're not in the game. And so tonight we're all participating. We're all here together. And I am the first to say it's not as together as I'd like it to be. But we are still here together. And maybe in a couple of weeks we'll be like, all right, we're back together. Maybe we can use a little time less together. I don't know. That could happen too. But I'm sure that regardless of how it all works out, that we'll be okay. And so for the new people in here today, and new people, I want to say one thing about that. The man that picked me up out of jail, that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, he used to say that in the first 5 years in AA, you shouldn't be allowed out in public without an AA chaperone. That was his rule of thumb. That's what he thought about people who are new, that you should have a lot of help. I essentially agree with that that sentiment. And even though it's the Simple Actions group, and I wouldn't have done this had I been in person with everybody, so I've already found out one benefit of doing that, because I'm standing in my house so I can say this. Another friend of mine in AA used to say, what we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a $1 million program. The problem is the first 5 years, you're going to feel like it's getting shoved up your ass a nickel at a time. And this is one of those times where it feels like the nickels are coming faster than I'd like them to. But we are, we've got the same program that's kept alcoholics sober since 1935 that's created this worldwide fellowship of millions of people. And there's a bunch of us out there tonight that are scrambling to figure out how to do this. And so while I'm standing here feeling clumsy and awkward doing this, there's a bunch of people just like me, probably also old timers, who are like, man, I mean, let's get back to comfort. And it's just not going to be that way right now. It's going to be uncomfortable. And me personally, I'm going to have to pick up the phone more. I'm going to have to read literature more. A friend of mine down here who used to work for FEMA had a good suggestion last night. He said if it gets to the point where we figured out that this thing is more communicable than we'd like it to be, we can always decide to meet in a parking lot, four cars, and pull up so that our driver windows are all facing the inside. And we can roll our windows down and we can have a meeting that far apart. I'm willing to do that. We got lots of parking lots down here on the Outer Banks that are empty. And feels a little ghosty down here. But my friend Henry used to work for FEMA, and he's like, when disasters happen, you got to find a way. And it's people like him who are true old timer in the best sense that'll help us do that. And I'll do my part. And just like Bill Wilson said, willingness is the key. We're all willing to be here tonight. Our higher power hasn't gone anywhere. And we'll be okay. And if anybody needs to call me, if anybody, you know, my phone is still on, and we'll be together. So I love you all. I appreciate you allowing me to do this tonight. And maybe I'll get better at it if we have to do this much longer. But maybe not. Either way, I'm willing to go forward. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Trent. That was fantastic. Everybody find your applause emoji. Yay. Okay, so I'm going to leave the, we'll go through the normal announcements and things like that, and we'll all pray together before we close. And I'll give you the opportunity to unmute yourself. If you have an announcement, find out how to put your hand up. If you raise your hand, I'll call on you. We recorded this. This will be posted on the simpleactions.net website as usual. So that's available. I put the tidewaterintergroup.org link back in the chat line. And I'm just going to read that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. I still don't see any hands up yet. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Okay, I see Larry's hand. I'll get you in a second. I have a couple real quick. Tidewaterintergroup.org, not only is that a great place for you to go and maybe drop a couple of bucks on the Tidewater Intergroup to show your gratitude. It's also the place to go for up-to-date meeting closures. Everything that's been closed or temporarily closed has been updated on the Tidewater Intergroup website. We've also stood up a page that shows online meetings that are available. There's a noon meeting that's stood up every day at noon. Lots of other meetings are going online. Simple Actions is going to be here next week on Monday night. And so that page, I can copy this link too. But it's fairly easy to find if you go to tidewaterintergroup.org. On the first page, there's a COVID virus kind of red text, and it's linked in there. But that's the link to that. I just hit something. I want to stop screen sharing. Okay, I did something wrong. Anyway, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, I'll give you an email address. It's info@simpleactions.net. And if anybody is willing to be a sponsor or service sponsor, I'll invite you to put your name and phone number in the chat window if anybody's looking for a sponsor. And let's see. We had some hands up for announcements. Where's Larry? I just unmuted iPad. Pat, you want to make an announcement?
Yes, David. Just so everyone knows, VBRC is closed.
Okay, VBRC is closed. Okay, Eric.
You got me?
I got you. Hey, Eric.
Hey, hey, buddy. Nice work. Thanks for the service. Unfortunately, like most meetings, Outlaw will be shut down, but we're going to go a week-by-week basis, so we'll just keep everyone informed. Pass it on. Thanks.
Thank you. Also, by the way, this particular account that we have, max is out at 100, and I'm both saddened and happy to say that for the entire meeting, it was going around 99 to 100 participants, so I think we had more demand than we had supply. Larry, what you got?
Yeah, you already covered it. Just a reminder that noon meeting, you can access it via the Intergroup Online meeting page. And if any of your home groups are starting to cancel and you want to convert it to an online meeting, I think we can help you get that started if you need a hand. That's all.
Okay, great. I don't see any other hands. This has been awesome. Thank everybody who participated. There is no meeting after the meeting, except we're going to leave this. We'll leave this room open for anybody. Anybody can leave as they see fit, but people will probably still hang out here and chat. And you're welcome to do that. I'll unmute everybody for the Lord's Prayer. And BJ has volunteered to read the last two paragraphs on page 164.
My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic. Can I be heard?
Yes.
Hi. Gotcha.
Awesome. Trent, thank you so much for your story, man. That was really powerful. I wish we were there to thank you in person.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Page 164, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. Well, let's do the Lord's Prayer, and then I will remove the restriction. People can unmute themselves after we pray. And thank everybody for coming tonight. This was, as Trent pointed out, kind of weird and kind of amazing. So thank you all. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Everybody stay safe. And everyone is allowed to unmute themselves as they see fit. Come and go as you see fit. You don't have to stay here, but you don't have to go home.
Thank you, David.
Excellent. I'm already at home.
Thank you so much, Trent. Such a great job.
Yep. Thanks, everybody.
Trent, thanks, thank you Trent. So much. It's awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Thanks, Trent.
Thanks, Trent. Thanks, Trent.
Super awesome.
Thank you so much, Trent.
Thank you, Trent.
Thank you, Trent.
Thank you, Trent.
Thanks, David.